Welcome back to the Way We Parent podcast. Paula here. This is episode 6 of season 2, and today I have a wonderful interview for you with Dr. Christia Spears Brown. Dr. Christia is a PhD in developmental psychology, and she focuses her research on gender bias, racial bias, basically anything that has to do with stereotypes and biases and how that affects society, in specifically our children. In this episode, we talked a little bit about gender biases. We talked a little bit about immigration policies, a little bit about everything and how all of these things affect our children in our society. So I'm very, very excited for you guys to listen to this episode. But before we get started with that, I'm very excited that this week I received my first voice note from one of you guys. So if you didn't know, when you go to my Anchor page, which I will make sure is in the show notes, you can leave a voice message and that way it can be played during a future episode. I can answer your questions and you can be a part of the experience. So I'm going to play the message that I got and we're going to answer the question.
Hello, Paula. Yes, Carmen. I love your episode about unschooling, and I'm very intrigued by it. I love kids learning from nature, learning by themselves, learning what really interests them, and also really learning for life. I do remember back in school, I really just studied for the test, and after the test, whatever I learned, I kind of forgot, except for the subject I was actually interested in. A question though, if you do unschooling, especially in a more free way that doesn't require a homeschooling program, what do you do when your child does want to go to college? Let's say they do want to become a doctor, or they do want to become a nurse, or they want to become a lawyer, or anything that really requires you to have a degree, and then they do need to take those prerequisites that they have to have.
Okay, so the audio got cut off there a little bit, but this is a great question and one that I think a lot of people have. What I want to tell you guys is to go back to season 1 of the podcast and listen to episode 4, which is Growing Up Unschooled with Lauren Levine. So Lauren actually grew up unschooled, and in the episode she talks about how she actually got her high school diploma because she just decided to do that when she was a teenager. And she even took college courses. Now, in terms of going to university to become a lawyer or a doctor, like Carmen was asking, that's really, really going to depend on where you live and what the requirements are. So I really encourage you to do your own research in your own area. So if your child is really interested in a more academic path, that's going to come about as they get older, and they can always choose to go back to school. So that's the thing about unschooling. It doesn't have to be a lifelong thing. And they can still take the SATs. They can still get their their high school diploma and college degree. So I hope that helps. Again, I'm not the super expert on this. Obviously, I highly encourage you to check out Fair of the Free Child. That's FARE. That is a podcast by Akilah Richards, where the whole podcast is about unschooling and just sort of different types of schooling. So it is a really good wealth of information there. So yeah, I hope that was helpful. Thank you again for sending me a message. That was really exciting. And I hope you guys will do that as well, so we can be a part of the community. With all of that, without further ado, I will leave you guys with this amazing interview with Dr. Christia Spears Brown. Welcome, everybody. I am very, very excited today to be joined by Dr. Christia Spears Brown. She is the author of Parenting Beyond Pink and Blue, as well as Discrimination in Childhood and Adolescence. And she's also coming out with a new book called Unraveling Bias, How Prejudice Has Shaped Children for Generations and Why It's Time to Break the Cycle, which I cannot wait to dive into. It sounds amazing. But before we get to talking about all that good stuff, I wanted to ask you to tell us a little bit more about yourself, what your background is, and how did you get into this world of exploring biases and all of that?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me and having a conversation. So my background is, so I have a PhD in developmental psychology, and I went to graduate school to study these things. So I say I grew up in the South, and I think if you grow up in the South, you cannot be ambivalent on the topic of race. You are on one side or the other, I think. And so I remember thinking about kind of how race stereotypes affect kids when I was young, so high school. And then also started thinking really early in my life about the ways in which gender seems to have all of this baggage that we carry with us, right? And so, you know, even when we go to a McDonald's and they ask you, do you want a girl's toy or a boy's toy and a Happy Meal? I remember being, you know, 14 or 15 thinking, that just seems like a really crazy question. Like, how do I know? And so really early, I started thinking, we have all of these expectations about what people are like based on these really kind of superficial characteristics. And so when I was a psychology major in college and then was thinking about what I wanted to go do, I realized you could actually do research on these topics and you could figure out and ask questions about how does gender and the stereotypes that we have shape how kids develop. And so I've done this ever since. So it's been, gosh, more than 20 years of studying this and kind of thinking about how it's changed over time. So, you know, I started studying these topics in 1998. Things have changed quite a bit. And so research changes too. So, you know, we do things now looking at kind of the sexualization of girls and how that plays out on social media. You know, these were not questions we asked in 1998.
Right.
But it is how gender plays out in 2021. And so
the same themes in different ways.
I mean, it really is the same themes in different ways. And and we see that over, you know, really history of, we have expectations about people, we treat them a certain way, and that elicits the behaviors we expect. And that plays out regardless of the technology. It even changes across the groups.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, and everything is, so I read your book, Parenting Beyond Pink and Blue, and it was so transformative in a way, because I already sort of believed the idea that we shouldn't raise our children with such biases. But I think your book really opened my mind to just how prevalent it is, because I really think most people don't quite realize like how we're like, hello, boys and girls, and how we say, okay, let's do a boys team and a girls team. And it's just every little thing we do, it's boys and girls and boys and girls. And it's so reinforced in our day-to-day lives. And it's just crazy. I mean, I get into arguments on the internet all the time because people would be like, oh, but my boy's brain is different. And I'm like, you need to go read Dr. Brown's book, because it's not true. And so what I love about your book too, is you really dive into the research. And so it's not like it's not just your opinion. It's just actually, let's look at these facts, and it doesn't actually add up. Have you found a lot of kind of pushback from certain groups of people on the gender stuff?
Definitely. Yeah. Yes. And I would say some of it is based on this real belief that boys and girls are inherently different. And I'll say the reason I even wrote that parenting book was there had been another couple of books that had come out saying how boys and girls learn differently and how there's these really drastically different brains. And the problem was those people writing the books weren't researchers. They weren't representing the research well at all. You know, it was based on studies of like seven rat pups. And they were making these big kind of statements about how we should treat boys and girls differently based on these like rats. And even small studies at that from like the late 70s. But there's something I think intuitive that we like the idea that, you know, because you look around and you're like, well, men and women do seem really different, right? Like, my husband and I, for example, we communicate really differently oftentimes. So we want these like big essentialist explanations of we must just be almost like different species. You know, there's a reason that men are from Mars, women are from Venus, sold so many copies. But the problem is it just doesn't, like the research does not back that up at all. And so it was so frustrating to see people really buy into it, because I think it like satisfies our need to make the world a little bit simpler and to have kind of simple explanations. And so I was like, so frustrated that that stuff was starting to infiltrate schools and how teachers were teaching and how schools were set up. And I thought someone that actually does gender research and how it affects development should actually write a book and actually talk to teachers and parents, and as opposed to these guys that are doing this research that I think is frankly harmful to how both boys and girls are kind of developing.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree. And I've actually had people use those books, because I know the ones you're talking about, to say, well, no, actually, my boy is different. And I'm like, but are they? Like, there's no, is there actual backup to that? Mm-hmm. Now, I guess, so to kind of clarify for people, what you found in most of the research is that there isn't really an inherent difference between boys and girls other than socialization, correct?
Right. So there's been lots of good research and lots of studies. I mean, there's been thousands and thousands of studies looking for gender differences. And there's a woman at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, her name's Janet Hyde, who's a very well-respected researcher. And she does what's called meta-analyses, where she takes all this published research, so the hundreds and hundreds of studies, and puts it all into this one giant analysis to say, mm-hmm. if we take it all together, like, what's the take home? Is there a reliable difference that we see if we collapse all the research that's been done? And it takes about 1.5 million kids in this giant analysis. And she looks for about 80 different types of gender differences across all these types of math and language arts abilities and reading and athletic abilities and personality and emotion regulation and all the ways in which people can differ. And what she finds is that we have very, very few differences between boys and girls and men and women. There's a couple, mm-hmm. but most of them are minuscule or non-existent. So the idea is that individual boys seem to differ from one another, and individual girls differ from one another more than like the average boy differs from the average girl.
Right.
So it's not as though people don't differ, right? So you may have a son and a daughter and they differ a lot, but they're differing because they're different individuals, not just because they're gender. You know, and the differences are things like throwing ability and velocity. That is a difference that does seem to be a actual difference. So boys do seem to be able to throw faster and further. Now, that doesn't mean it's not because they didn't have a lot of practice, right? And so maybe dad was in the backyard throwing with the son more than with the daughter. But it is a difference that is measurably different.
Okay.
Boys seem to be a little bit worse at impulse control really young. So they're a little bit more impulsive, not a lot, just a little bit. And that's just on average. So I have two girls that were really impulsive when they were little, right? So there's lots of variation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's difference in the age with which boys and girls first start saying words. So girls are a little bit earlier than boys are by a couple of months, but again, not much. And it doesn't really tell you about an individual person.
And do we know, like, can we say for sure that that's not socialization?
Not at all. So that's the other important part of that. That's a good point, is that just because we see a difference doesn't mean it's an innate or a biological difference.
Right.
Yeah, there's some evidence that parents talk to daughters more than they're talking to sons. So not that they're neglecting their sons, but they're using just more language with their daughters than with their sons. And they're talking about different types of things. So it's not surprising that you're going to see differences.
Right.
And so a lot of neuroscientists are showing that there's really, really minuscule differences early. But because of the gender stereotypes and the expectations we have, we exaggerate and grow those differences over time.
That's amazing. And after puberty, can we say that there's more of a difference in their brain?
There are some differences that happen after puberty. I mean, there's differences that happen across development because we know experiences shape the brain as much as the brain shapes experiences, right? And so if you give people different experiences, that shapes what neural connections they have, and they begin to lose some of the abilities that they would have had had they been given those experiences. So for example, if we don't hear certain kinds of languages when we're really young, we physically lose the ability to hear some of those fine distinctions in the languages. Mm-hmm. So we know that there's these kind of critical periods where we need to have exposure, mm-hmm. or we lose the ability. So part of it is that those differences continue to happen over time. Those, because we have different worlds we live in, our brains develop differently. And then puberty does bring a whole different set of issues, because that is where you start to see body differentiation.
Right.
So, you know, I always get frustrated that there's like different expectations for boys and girls in elementary school in terms of athletics, where in elementary school, boys and girls' bodies are really very, very similar. Often girls are bigger than boys are and stronger than boys are. But puberty is where you start to see some differences. But even then, not as different as people often assume.
Yeah. The other argument that I've had people say to me is, well, if you don't believe that boys and girls are different, then how do you explain trans children? Do you have an answer to that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have an answer to that, but I'll say it's a good question. And it's something that gender researchers are thinking a lot about.
Okay.
And so there's not a great answer. I think that partly because we don't know why some kids are cisgender and some kids are transgender. So we believe that they are. We believe kids when they say, this is who I am.
Right.
So kids seem to have a sense of who they are early.
Right.
But it seems to be complex.
Okay.
And we're just trying to, you know, researchers are just now kind of trying to figure that out. Mm-hmm. I tend to think, if boys and girls were so drastically different, then we wouldn't have, I mean, I think trans kids are evidence for the fact that the gender distinctions we have don't really fit well. Because there are some kids who are come into the world and say, this category does not fit me.
Right.
And so clearly these are things that are spectrums and not this clear-cut binary that we kind of like to think. You know, there's also a lot of kids that are gender nonconforming in other ways. So they wouldn't identify as trans, but they are saying, I don't fit in this binary, or I am, you know, kind of, I like that folks use sometimes is kind of gender creative of neither of these fits me well. I'm somewhere in the middle, or I'm neither. And I think that it just highlights how this kind of focus on a binary that's got these strong biological predispositions just doesn't work for a lot of kids. And we don't really know why, but it's another reason I don't like gender bias, like gender stereotypes and these strong gender categories. I think it makes it worse for the kids that fit neatly in the category, and it makes it worse for the kids that don't fit neatly in the categories.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, I think the next 10 years will tell us about what seems to be driving gender identity.
Yeah. Like it'd be interesting to know if all kids were raised in a sort of gender creative way, which we're seeing a lot more of people who are raising their kids without assigning them a gender. If they would have those those feelings, but then at the same time, I guess, you know, the problem is we equate gender with sex, right? With our organs, and doesn't.
Right. I do wish we could live in a world, and I think this is a thought experiment at this point. I'm not optimistic enough to think of this will happen, but if you're born and you have a certain set of genitalia that your doctor sees, and then you're allowed to just identify how you want and dress how you want and express yourself how you want. So wearing dresses and nail polish and makeup and long hair was completely independent of whether you had a vagina or a penis, right? And so you could have a vagina or a penis, but how you express yourself in the world and how you feel about yourself was completely up to you. And I think in that world, everyone could find the place that fit them well, and we wouldn't kind of pathologize like we do now, not fitting neatly in the category that matches your, you know, genitals.
I love that.
That just seems like a crazy idea. You have this one body part that's supposed to determine so much about you. We're like, yet. If you just let kids just be them and put no restrictions on it, I just wonder how things would, I have a feeling a lot of kids would be much happier with themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And I love that what you mentioned is like, if we could all just find where we are in our society, and like, if we could just find what works for us, if we wouldn't pathologize. I think that's a really important word, because I think that's what we do now when it comes to, as we're talking more and more about trans rights and all of that, is this idea of like, it's this like illness, like we're trying to find a reason because it's not the way it's supposed to be, but maybe it's just society's not the way it's supposed to be.
Right. That's what I would say is. Yeah, I would say society's not the way it's supposed to be. It's saying that we have such expectations based on what you're supposed to be like. We have to give you a separate label. We have to make it difficult for you to use the restroom you want to use or to play on the sports team you want to play on. Yeah. When kids are just trying to be kids, right? But I definitely think it's the society that needs to change, not the kids.
Amen to that. I'm curious to know too, because we have, some cultures, like I know some indigenous cultures have what they call two-spirit people, correct? I don't know if you guys have done research around that and just how that plays out, because, and I don't believe it's just indigenous cultures. I know it's in other parts of the world as well, where they've always had sort of this like third gender.
Yeah. There are, and I think there's, more and more documented cases of kind of cultures that do that, because the reality is this is the way people are born. The reality is that there are also a lot of people born that are biologically what they call intersex. So they have ambiguous genitalia that's kind of somewhere between the typical male and the typical female. Yeah. And there's actually quite a bit of that doctors correct in the hospital, and that doesn't get actually recorded. So some researchers estimate that those numbers are much higher than we actually even realize. And so I think that there has always been a lot of variation in gender identity, kind of as we use it in the modern, vernacular. But in terms of how people feel, has always varied. It's just how much restrictions does their society put on how they can show it. Trans folks have always existed. They just were much more kind of in the shadows and hid it, or were really unhappy. And so I think some cultures just acknowledge it better.
Yeah.
I think kind of Western cultures, for whatever reasons, have been very restrictive as how people can express themselves. But I mean, you see it with race too. I mean, we do a lot of restrictions on a lot of social groups. I mean, race, you see similar restrictions as well.
I think it's this trying to get everybody to fit into this neat little box that we can understand. And, unfortunately it works for a very small part of the population.
I mean, I think it's because we have such, we've had such traditional gender differentiated roles, right? So it's women have babies and stay at home, and men kind of take a secondary parenting role and go to work and make more money where their work is more valued, right? We've really differentiated society based on gender and gender roles and, kind of historically. And so I think when you have a system set up where everyone knows what they're supposed to do in society based on whether they're a man or a woman, when people don't fit that, it throws off the whole kind of social order. As opposed to saying, maybe the person that wants to be raising the kids stays home, and the person that can, wants to go and work works, and the person that wants to have the daycare job has the daycare job. If we took gender out of all of those, it would be less stressful. To cope with folks that didn't fit neatly.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we can see that the people who have those differences, whatever way that may be, like enrich our society. It doesn't, I think people are afraid of what's different, but it actually makes our society better and more complex and more interesting and, all the things. So
Yeah, I think that's all been it. I think people get scared of what they don't understand or can't relate to. Or I just think that makes things so much more interesting, yeah. Right? Like the diversity of humanity is I am just fascinated with and love it and think it makes things so much better. But you got to just say it's okay to feel a little uncomfortable and to say I don't really understand that, but let me learn and let me just be open to things that are different than my experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think where it gets really difficult for me to sort of, because I can empathize with that feeling of being a little bit wary and not like, this is different. I don't get it. But I think, and we see this, of course, still, especially in the United States and in other parts of the world, where it then translates to hate, and it translates to policy, unfortunately, and discrimination and all of that. And so that I have such a hard time understanding that, like, you know, people who want to still to this day ban gay marriage. It's like, you don't have to understand why somebody would be attracted to the same gender, but why do you care? That's always my thing. It's like, why do you care? How does it affect your life? And I think, yeah, I mean, I know you probably talk about that a little bit in your book, but I don't know what your thoughts are there.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what my new book talks quite a bit about, is that mix of how biases get in our policies and our laws too. Because I have, like, over time really started thinking more and more about, you know, it's only so much to change prejudices and stereotypes in our individual kids, right, and in individuals, so kind of in our hearts and minds. But it's also so embedded in our institutions. But the problem is there's this, like, cycle of you have biases in your institutions, right, and then that leads to kind of discrepancies or differences. And so we develop stereotypes and prejudices based on what we're seeing. And when we have stereotypes and prejudices, we're not inclined to change the policies. So it's like, right, you have policies that, you know, support and strengthen our stereotypes and biases. And then when we have those biases, we don't want to change the policies because the policies are aligned with how we believe the world should be. And so it's like, we really have to try to tackle them both. And I think as simultaneously as possible, like change people's hearts and minds, but also change who we're voting for and what policies our schools are doing and what kinds of things we support with our, you know, pocketbooks. Because the institutional level bias is really keeps all the other stuff in check. Like, we can't really change, you know, for example, like children's media, for example, even as an institution. If kids are not seeing gender diverse people, then they're going to continue to feel uncomfortable around gender diverse people.
Yeah.
But so, like, media has to change who they're representing.
Yeah.
Before people feel comfortable interacting with that, right? So it's like, absolutely, both things have to change. And we see it when it happens sometimes. So, you know, right now we're seeing a lot with, like, trans kids and teenagers in terms of school athletics and the bathrooms they can use at schools. And I think that'll be the next decade's legal battles.
Yeah.
And we're seeing it at the state level, and we're seeing it at the, you know, federal level, and we're seeing it across different countries. So I think that'll be, but again, it's stereotypes and prejudices have to change before we don't vote for people that want to ban certain people from playing school sports. But as long as the politicians are saying these kids are dangerous, then people are going to believe that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as long as, yeah, we don't understand it. Right. And that's, mm-hmm, I think, what it comes down to. I always find that so interesting, like the whole argument that people are afraid to have trans folks in the bathroom because, you know, what if my daughter gets sexually abused? And I'm thinking, like, what's stopping her from getting sexually abused now? Like, what's stopping a cisgender male from going in the bathroom?
Exactly.
Like, you know, I mean, and I mean, I know that sounds even more scary, but it doesn't equate in my brain why you need to ban a whole group of people from your bathroom.
Yeah, it does. I think that's it, is that that prejudices don't hold up to logic. I think that's the thing time and again, is that, you know, whether it be the gender differences we were talking about earlier to these kinds of prejudices, when you apply, like, logic and kind of facts to it, they never hold up.
Right.
And so I think that's the key, is helping people like think through the logical argument. Mm-hmm. And so I think unbiased beliefs do ultimately win the day. It just takes people kind of being open to thinking about, okay, what do the facts really say? Like, who's more likely to be assaulted? Actually, trans individuals are much more likely right. to be the victims of assault, much, much more likely than to do any of the assaulting. Mm-hmm. And so we just have to really kind of be open to what's the evidence out there, and let me let the evidence guide my beliefs instead of the other way around.
Yeah, 100%. I love that. And so you did Parenting Beyond Pink and Blue back then. And so that was specifically on gender. This book, it seems like you're focusing more on biases around race. Is that right?
This one kind of tries to tackle a lot of it, partly okay. because I think they're all pretty related. So it's biases about race and immigration mm-hmm. and gender and LGBTQ status.
Amazing.
Partly because I say most kids are affected by bias in some way 100%. Or another.
Yep.
Really everyone is in some group that is stereotyped and faces harassment or bias.
Yeah.
For the most part. But we're also in groups that have privileges oftentimes too. Probably the most privileged group we have are, you know, cis, straight, white boys. But yet even they face biases, really in the sense that there's this very narrow definition of what they're allowed to be. So if they show emotion or ask for help or want to be nurturing and caring or say they like to read poetry, all things that get those boys teased and harassed and bullied in middle school.
Right.
Right. So they get teased for trying to be anything but that really kind of toxic masculinity stereotype. And so that's also limiting them, right? Yes, they yeah. will grow up to make more money, but they don't feel as free to express their emotion, or to, maybe they want to stay home and raise their babies and they don't necessarily feel, you know, kind of culturally allowed to do that. So I think there's biases even among those that are privileged in many other ways.
Absolutely. We're seeing also this rise, I don't know if this is something you touch upon, but of boys who are committing these atrocious crimes out of this sort of entitlement to have a partner, a sexual partner. And so what you see is that these men are being rejected. And it's so unbearably, you know, painful that they go up and I mean literally like cause mass shootings and all kinds of stuff. It's really awful. It's crazy. I know, to me.
I think it's crazy to me too. And I think it just is a symptom of a very extreme symptom of a couple of trends. One is that we foster aggression and hostility in boys, right? Mm-hmm. Every toy they're given when they're little has got a gun or some kind of, you know, weapon attached to it. And every video game, like, you know, so we foster so much aggression. And we see it in lots of other ways. When boys show aggression, we don't penalize it, but we do in girls. I mean, there's at every level, we allow boys to be really aggressive and kind of angry. Sure. We don't allow them to express other emotions like sadness or grief. It has to kind of be funneled through this aggressive lens. And at the same time, we have this real push for boys to get status and prove their masculinity by how many girls they can date or have sex with. Mm-hmm. And so you see that even when people ask their toddler, you know, when little preschool boys, they're like, oh, how many girlfriends do you have? You know, it's kind of the well-meaning grandparents ask, oh, right. Is that your girlfriend? I mean, from the very right. So from the very beginning, we attach their social status to their ability to attract women. Mm-hmm. And we see that elementary school kids are already endorsing that idea that boys should be able to get as many girlfriends as they want. And girls and boys are saying that. And so I think you put those two things together, that you only, your self-worth is based on how many women you can acquire yeah. in a very objectified way.
Yeah.
And we foster aggression and we penalize you for asking for help and for showing your like legitimate emotions.
Yeah.
And so for some people, they take that to the extreme. I mean, I think those are, you know, extreme examples, but I think it's a function of the cultural trends that we see in more kind of normative ways.
Yeah. And what's interesting to me is what I'll, some sort of the other side of the narrative that I'll hear is people are saying, well, it's feminism that's ruining everything. It's because we're telling women that they, you know, that they're strong and whatever. And, or that's what these boys will say, which is so fascinating to me, like the sort of mental gymnastics people will run through. But I mean, in a way I could see that, because I do think that any of like anyone who's fighting towards gender equality and just equality in general is a threat to these people, right?
Right, right.
It's a threat to the order, yeah.
Yeah, and saying no, you know, saying no is shows power. And I guess when, I don't know, it does seem ridiculous that feminism is apparently responsible for women saying no, you may not have sex with me, yeah. Right? Like yeah. that's a pretty low bar there. But yeah, I do think, having, you know, and what we see this, I think, in some recent just political trends too, is when groups that have long been marginalized or disenfranchised or silenced speak up and say, you can't do this to me anymore. Mm-hmm. It is threatening to those that are used to having all the right. power, mm-hmm. As though it's this kind of zero sum game. And so I think you see people that have long been used to being in privileged positions feeling threatened by people speaking up and saying, no, you have to treat me like a full person.
Yeah. Do you think that it's always a very sort of conscious thing for people? Or is it really like some people are just not aware of their own privilege and how that affects them? Does that make sense?
Yes, I would say almost everything we've talked about is not conscious by folks. You know, right. I think most people, if you ask them, I mean, there's clearly exceptions, but most people believe, mm-hmm. at least on the surface, that people should be treated equally, and that they're like, that they believe in equality, and that if you work hard, you should be, mm-hmm. you know, have the same outcomes. I don't think that this is a conscious decision. I think that I think that's almost a function of the privilege. I think if you've been in positions of power and privilege your whole life, you don't see it anymore. So I think there's, for male privilege and for white privilege, both, I think, operate similarly. Mm-hmm. When you're used to setting the narrative and you're used to seeing your stories represented and you're used to being the group whose voice is treated as the default,
right?
You don't even, you don't recognize it. It's hard. It's hard to see. Because it's by design, you know, right. That privilege is by design. And so I think for them, they don't notice. Right. It's only for the people that don't see their faces represented or don't hear their voices represented or have their opinions valued that are mindful of it. But everyone else is like, well, of course you're treated equally, because they don't realize that that other people have different experiences than them.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely, I 100% agree. And I've seen that so much in recent years too. And with everything, with the political climate and everything that kind of is talked about now. And yeah, I think one of the realizations that I had that was like a big aha moment was when I realized that, you know, people will say there's no such thing as white culture. And that's, again, that's a function of white privilege, because there is absolutely a white culture. We just are, it's just the norm. It's seen as right. the thing that is. So when people talk about things like, you know, professionalism, when people talk about manners, when people talk anything like that, that is considered correct, that's right. a function of our white supremacy. Like it's not
right.
It's only right because that's what you've been taught to believe. And then it, of course it gets used as a weapon against people who are different. So it's just so fascinating, because I grew up that way and I thought, well, this is the right way, but there is no right way.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I just, I think that is what's tricky, I think, is that, and I think that's tricky for everyone, is when you only see one version of how things should be, it is hard to realize that that is just your cultural version, mm-hmm. and it is not some universal truth.
Right.
And whites and men have, by and large, set the narrative, right? They were the ones, they're the ones making media. They're the ones writing the textbooks. Yeah. They're the ones hiring the teachers. So every way in which we get information is controlled by one group. And so I think quite unconsciously, usually, they don't realize that there's another way because they're saying, well, of course this is the way it was because it's how they were taught and it fits their version of reality. Mm-hmm. And so then things get perpetuated across generations because it's the same group maintaining power. And so then it's, you know, and it's like you see this in hiring of, well, this person would fit better in our culture. This person, you know, I connected with them.
Right.
Well, you connected with them because they're just like you. Right. And so then we perpetuate only hiring people that are just like you.
Yeah.
And I think that's how, And it's like we just got to be more comfortable with things that are different and think, oh, wow, this diversity in whatever way, race, you know, country of origin, gender, sexual orientation, diversity enriches the spaces we're in, whether it be schools or workplaces, and just be like, it's okay to feel uncomfortable. Like that's an okay feeling and I'll get used to it. And it's a part of growth, right? It's, you know, growth is a little uncomfortable. So you got to be a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. So, I mean, I love how I'm kind of looking through the contents of your book, which again, I'm super excited about. But so you talk about all of these things and you talk about how they affect our children's lives. One thing I see here that you're talking about is immigration and the lives of Latino American children. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how you see that and how that can affect our Latin American kids?
Yeah. So we know that, so part of what I talk about in the book is that, you know, we know kids by elementary school, so non-Latino kids have stereotypes about, for example, Mexican immigrants that mirror a lot of the political rhetoric that we see about work ethic and, you know, being lazy and all of that. We see as the political rhetoric kicks up, we see harassment and bias towards Latino kids kick up. And Latino kids are experiencing discrimination and reporting it. And that's affecting their sense of school belonging. It's affecting how well they're doing at school.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you think here's these kids that are often bilingual, which is a fabulous strength, and yet they often get stereotyped for being dumb. And I'm like, these kids are bilingual in a sea of monolingual Americans, and yet we're not appreciating the extra kind of cognitive effort that that took. And we know that they're experiencing a lot of bias. And we also know things that like feeling really strong and positive about your identity, whether, you know, for kids that might identify as, for example, Mexican American or Latino American, like feeling proud about that is really protective and helps. So partly it's how can we reduce biases of the other kids and how can we help the Latino kids feel really proud of who they are and where they come from and their family, because that's a powerful thing. And then I talk a lot about the policy. So, you know, we've had a long history of really atrocious policies towards immigrants, particularly, you know, immigrants from Mexico and Central America. And, you know, I think that we treat particularly Mexican immigrants as the scapegoats and have historically. So when there's an economic downturn, people like to blame immigrant workers, for example, of, you know, taking American jobs. And they've done that for a long time. And it just, again, it isn't the reality. They actually enhance economies, local economies. So, and I think that when we have policies focused on criminalizing immigration and focus on deportation and things like that, that harms kids. Kids live in a, you know, Latino immigrant kids, particularly if they have a parent parent who doesn't have kind of documentation of citizenship, they live in a very fearful world of having their parent taken away, and that harms how kids develop. And I just think we criminalize kind of crazy things in this country. And I think that that's one of them. I was like, I think what do we think is best for kids? It's being, having supportive families, being able to go to a high quality school, being treated equally. And I think that's a large group of kids we don't do that for.
Yeah, no, I totally see that. I'm Latino myself. I'm Chilean, and I immigrated to Canada when I was 12. And so obviously Canada is a little bit different. Obviously our immigration policies are a bit more open. and we came here as like landed immigrants, which has a whole different feel to it than being like a refugee, or, you know, it's just different in terms of the privileges you get and whatnot. But yeah, I definitely, like, right away, as soon as I went to school and I told somebody that I was Hispanic, it was like, oh, you're Mexican, right? And there's all these stereotypes, and that, you know, I was 12 years old, but it's just so interesting. Like, even though Canada doesn't have the same kind of Mexican population and the whole immigration thing that happens in the States, those stereotypes continue, because here in Canada, we're very much attuned to American culture and American media. And so, and so kids already pick that up. Right. And so, yeah, I experienced all of that. And at the same time, I feel like it was a very interesting intersection from that, but also being white and also sort of having that privilege and being able to eventually now sort of not, it's not the first thing that comes to people's mind. Like, they don't look at me, you're Latino. So that comes with its own privileges. So it's just really interesting, because basically none of these stereotypes make sense for me. You know, you can't peg me as who I am because of all of these stereotypes based on how I look.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's an interesting kind of issue, where we have racialized groups that aren't racist, right? So we treat kind of Latino or Hispanic as a race, when it's clearly not. But we ascribe all this other kind of meaning to it. And it's also, what's interesting too, I think, is terms like Latino or Hispanic only have meaning in this culture. It's like, it's no one that lives in South America would describe themselves. Like, it's not a meaningful term, except in the context of kind of immigration. My guess is when you were 9, you would have never described yourself as Hispanic. I mean, you would probably say you're Chilean.
Yeah. I mean, actually there is like a Latino culture. Like, you would, I did hear that growing up, and I, like, you know, and more in like a pride and like Latinos, we are this way, whatever. And I think, but again, that to me, that has a lot to do with the fact that American, media is so prevalent all over the world. And
yes,
and it's something I it frustrates me to no end, because for some reason the United States is still very much a superpower in the sense of the media, right? Like, Hollywood movies are still the biggest around the world, and so people really look up to the United States in a cultural way. When you actually look at policy wise, like, the United States is really behind on a lot of stuff, you know, and I say this, I know most of my listeners are American, but I talk about this all the time because it's frustrating to me, you know. People in South America look up to the United States. I was trying to tell my grandparents this. I was like, guys, like, stop looking up to the United States. Like, they don't even have maternity leave.
No, we're the only developed country that doesn't. We are terrible when it comes to parenting support policies.
We are
one of the worst in the world. We're definitely the worst of kind of what we say developed countries. Yes. Right. I think people don't realize how bad it is. We have zero paid parental leave.
It's really bad. Yeah.
And they give you 6 weeks off to not get fired. And that's like it. Like,
with
you don't even have your stitches out after 6 weeks if you're a if you're a mother that had a difficult delivery.
Right. Right. And I know, and I talk about this all the time, but I think also for a lot of Americans, they don't realize how not okay that is. Like, they just think, I'm lucky I got a few weeks off, and not realizing that countries that are considered developing countries, I say that in quotes, mm-hmm. have actually more benefits for their moms and parents. And so it's wild. It's wild to me. But yeah, I think it's interesting how you talk about that, and just how Latino children are affected by that. And I definitely can see that. And also in media, right? Like we talked about, is the lack of representation. And that was something else I kind of wanted to discuss, because I think I remember, honestly, so clearly, there was, if you're familiar with Shonda Rhimes, mm-hmm. and her shows, and mm-hmm. she does a pretty good job of having diverse casts. Mm-hmm. And there's one show that I watch, How to Get Away with Murder. And there's mm-hmm. a character in it, who's just, she's one of the characters, she's a lawyer or whatever. And it sort of comes up later that she's Hispanic, and then they go see her family and whatever, but it's not like the thing about her identity. Mm-hmm. And you know, she's white like me, and I remember just being so shocked by this, but also so happy about it. I was like, mm-hmm. there's a Hispanic girl or Latina girl who her being Latino is not her whole identity,
right?
And I was so happy about that. And because we don't see that, right? We see the Sofia Vergaras on media who are like super bold and extra, and, right. and that's great too, but then that's what people expect. And so then for someone like me, like, if they don't get that, they're like, well, then you're not really Latino, like, because you don't act like right. like Sofia Vergara does on that show. So do you know what I mean? Like, we have it's just something that I feel like most people don't think about.
And I think that's the problem with the lack of representation. It's that it's not that any of those depictions are bad. It's just when there's only one or two, they're expected to carry the weight of everybody from that group, right? Right? They're never going to be able to represent the diversity of an entire like ethnic or cultural group.
Right.
And so when you only have one or two, it's of course going to be inadequate, because it's only one small kind of person. And I think that's why we just need the sheer number of people depicted have to improve. Yeah. And you have to see more diverse people doing writing and producing and right. things like that. So that just more variety. Again, it's that whole story of get back to human diversity. There's a lot of diversity. So the only way to appreciate that is to see it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you talk about in your book at the sort of towards the end, you talk about moving forward and some things we can do. Is there anything you can leave people with in terms of what they can start doing at home to combat these issues?
Well, I think the quick one, and it also echoes my parenting gender book, is just talking about that more with kids, right? Yeah. I think we often think kids don't develop biases or stereotypes, or they don't experience it because they're too young. Mm-hmm. But to just talk about it, because kids are endorsing biases, they're experiencing biases. And so recognize what stereotypes are. So when you notice one, point it out. So instead of trying to shield it, do the opposite of pointing it out and talking about it, to say, that looks like a stereotype about that. Or it's a shame we can't see more people that look like her, but with a different family. Or,
right.
you know, like pointing it out so that kids become more critical consumers of the media that they see, so that they can recognize stereotypes and biases for what they are, as opposed to some reality, right? Like, to learn that it's not this inevitable reality, but that's a stereotype. So what can we do? So I think that's probably the biggest one is, you know, and that's a consistent message I have of the best way to battle something is to know what it is you're battling.
Right.
And parents often want to like shield, but that doesn't work. You can't shield kids from this stuff. It's just too pervasive.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. And I'm cautiously optimistic. Just as someone who, because of my job, I spend time on social media, mm-hmm. I do feel like there is more diversity. Like, that's one benefit of social media, mm-hmm. is that it allows everybody to have a platform. And as such, we see different people. And what I'm seeing is young people, you know, the new generations, they're really starting to, it's really just starting to be the norm for them. So, you know, because they've grown up talking about trans folks, and that it's sort of normal to them. And you, if you were to ask most teenagers, they would think like, of course, gay people are going to get married. Like, what do you mean? Like, that's not a thing, you know, it's becoming the norm. And it just makes me really hopeful that that's the case.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's some new data that shows that something like 1 in 4, 1 in 5 kids would identify as gender diverse in some way, wow. Gender nonconforming, whether it be trans or gender fluid, or, you know, where your kind of gender identity changes. I mean, the numbers are, I think it was a Pittsburgh study that just came out that tried to be kind of representative and found, I think it was like 20%. Yeah. Whereas like 5 years ago, numbers would have been like 3% of the population. They're saying now it's like, you know, 1 in 5 kids are saying, yeah, that gender doesn't work for me. And so I think it is. I think it is really this cultural shift of saying, no, I get to choose how I identify and how I feel in the world.
Yeah.
And I think that's rapidly changing. And I do think that's the benefit of social media. Is to show kids there are options.
Totally.
And I think I think it might lead to some kind of discomfort, even for kids sometimes, because I think they want to know what they are, you know, in that kind of sense, but they're like, I don't know, this doesn't really fit me. So they kind of work through it. And I think that's just part of identity development. And just, I think kids have always worked through identity development as teens, and now gender has been added to the list of things they can explore. And I think that's great. It might add a little bit of, you know, anxiety to kids trying to figure it out, but I think it'll ultimately end up with much happier adults because they're allowed to kind of be who they're going to be.
Yeah. Well, and I think my brain automatically goes to like thinking about what the other side will say, and how this is all a function of the agenda to turn all our kids gay. And it's the cool thing to do.
Oh, I definitely, I hear that. Yes.
The back of my mind. Yeah, there's this woman telling me.
I definitely get that on my own social media feed.
Yeah.
I just think, you know, it's impossible to turn kids gay, right? You couldn't turn gay kids straight. So why do we think we could turn straight kids gay, right? It just does not work that way. Again, the logic doesn't hold up, because if you could do that, then, you know, there would have been lots of parents who made their kids straight, and that doesn't work either. So, yes.
Yeah. Well, and I think what you said about it, you know, like that the percentages have grown, it's not that more kids are gender fluid, it's that they are allowed to be gender fluid. Yes. So again, it's that distinction. It's like people are not gayer than they were
right,
before.
Right.
They just are not in the closet anymore,
right.
Which is a great thing.
Yeah. And we're asking the questions better. I mean, that's also part of it too, is that the people responding to the questions are being able to be more honest. And I think a lot of people, you know, historically would have just been depressed, for example, and not able to put a label on why, or to kind of understand why. And now with the vocabulary and the image and like the model role models that show diverse gender and sexual orientations, people can be like, oh, that fits me. That's partly why I'm unhappy, because that fits me better than what I'm currently doing. Yeah. Whereas I think before that was an option, people didn't know what to do with, I just don't feel right in my skin.
Yeah.
And so I think now we're giving people the language for, oh, wait a minute, this is a better way for me. Yeah. I don't think people have changed. I think how we measure it has changed. And I think how people are able to express themselves has changed. And I think that's always good.
Yeah. And knowing it's okay.
But there will be growing pains, right?
Yeah. And knowing it's okay, because I think that there's still, you know, and we still see this again, like there's still very conservative places where it's still seen as like a sin to be mm-hmm. a certain way. And so kids are being told it's wrong. Like even when they, before, you know, even when they do see it, they're like, it's wrong. But now they're seeing it enough on media and whatnot that they can be told it's no, it's actually, it's fine. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, much to the detriment of people who want to keep things the same.
Yeah. And I do think, like, I understand that. But there's so much research, you know, when you think about like trans kids, that shows the really, really devastatingly high rate of suicidality, like of committing suicide, of thinking about suicide. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, maybe you're uncomfortable with the kids saying they're trans, but the consequence of that is like those kids are killing themselves at like horrendously high rates. Like maybe be a little uncomfortable if it means you might save the life of your child. Mm-hmm. I think the cost benefit of that, like, yes, it's cost, you know, it's costing me a little bit of discomfort, but the benefit is my child doesn't think about suicide. That just seems to be worth it. I think that's it. It's like the stakes are so high for not accepting kids for how they are that we have to just kind of figure out how to get over ourselves.
Right. Yeah, you couldn't have said it better. I totally, totally agree. I can't wait for people to read your book and to, you know, to spread this message more. I tell everybody to read Parenting Beyond Pink and Blue all the time. Yeah. And I mean, I'm, you know what? And I'll say I'm still working through this in terms of how I see gender. Like if my son were, like, I have a 2-year-old boy, and if he were to ask me to wear a dress, I would say yes. But for some reason, I don't put him in a dress myself, you know? And I question myself, I'm like, why don't I do that? Like, why is that? Why do I still shop in the boys section? And so we all have stuff to work through. So there's no such thing as like someone who's perfect and is like totally enlightened and has worked through all their biases. Like, I'm still like, oh, yeah, but like, do I want people asking me if he's a boy or a girl? I'm like, you know, it's ridiculous. But I
think that's true. I think that's true for everybody. And I will say, I do think it's harder when you have sons than when you have daughters on mm-hmm. that exact topic. I think it's easier for me to have dressed my girls in boy clothes than it is the you know, reverse, because I think there is asymmetry with that.
Yeah.
But I also think we do always have biases also, because the biases that we've seen get really imprinted on our brain. And mm-hmm. so there's things really outside of our conscious control that we really have to override. And that takes a lot of effort. Mm-hmm. And the things are always changing. Like, these are moving targets too. So you're like, okay, I'm on top of it in 2015. Well, then by 2018, there's new issues to deal with. And then by 2021, things have evolved even more. So it's a constant. So not only are we having to work over a lot of, you know, biased inputs, we also are having to constantly be changing because the world and our understanding of the world is changing.
Totally.
So it is a daily thing.
And challenging what we thought. And mm-hmm. I actually did a gender reveal for my son. Like, we did a gender reveal party mm-hmm. and now I cringe at myself. I'm like, why would I? And now I can't, every time I see like online, and I'm sure like if someone's listening, I apologize, but there's often people like in their bios on their social media, it'll say mm-hmm. boy mom or girl mom. And it drives me nuts because I'm like, why do you have to identify like what gender you're, like, what does it matter? Yeah. You're a mom, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I was the mom who threw a gender reveal party and it's like, we're having a boy. You know? And now I'm like, why? And that was like 2 years ago. It wasn't that long ago, you know? Yeah. So it's just funny. My point to say is that we all evolve and we do. It's okay to change your mind and to say you were wrong or mm-hmm. you just didn't have all the information. I mean, I don't think what I did was like harmful, but it just wasn't what I would do now. So,
right. Yeah. And I think, I mean, I'm the same exact way. I think that's all we can do. And I think mm-hmm. that's it, is just being open to learning new information and mm-hmm. then letting that new information guide what we do. I think that's really the only way forward, and to not beat yourself up over things. Right. Mm-hmm. I think that we all do our best and we all mess up and we're also all, you know, products of our culture too. You know, I think a lot about this stuff, and I'm also a product of my culture too. So I think all we can do is just be mindful of it. And when we mess up, especially in front of our kids, or we do a thing where you're like, I really wish I wouldn't have done that, saying, you know what, I'm going to redo what I said before. Because, you know, like also like letting your kids know, I kind of messed up on that, or I want to do it differently. Because also it teaches that this isn't a fixed thing, that these are kind of having what we call a growth mindset of it, of we all get better and it's okay.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I, you know, and I know what you're saying, I think makes a lot of sense, where it's not just about what we do at home, but it has to do with policy too. Mm-hmm. But I do want to also still say to people who are listening at home is, you have a lot of power as parents to change society. You know, it does start with all of us. And if we can, because again, like, we're seeing this new generation is becoming more open-minded. And as that changes with us, right? The more we allow that to happen, the more we'd raise our kids with that growth mindset that you mentioned, the more we are respectful of their choices and we allow them to be who they are, the more that they can then grow up to be those role models and continue that cycle. So, you know, I'm so happy that you have those, that information out there for people to read and to understand, because I think that's incredibly empowering for parents and it makes a big impact.
Well, thanks.
But yeah, so anyways, I don't want to take up too much of your time. So thank you so much for joining me. Where can people find you?
So you can go to my website. So it's ChristiaBrown.com.
Yeah.
And I have a Twitter at the same name. So @ChristiaBrown.
Yeah.
And yeah, the new book, Unraveling Bias, will come out in November. So it's a lot of these same kind of issues. So I think it's a little bit more serious in tone in some ways in the parenting book, but it's really the same kind of themes of just, let's expand our kind of lens out a little bit and see all of these things that seem to matter.
Yeah. And it's already available for pre-order, right? People can go ahead and buy that. That's amazing. And I'm also seeing you do have, and I know I've checked it out before, your blog. Are you still doing the blog?
I am. I'm trying to, the book kind of sucked up my life a bit. Okay. So, but yeah, so I have a Psychology Today blog as well called, Beyond Pink and Blue.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some really good, pieces on there. So definitely check that out. And, again, thank you so much for joining us today. And, I can't wait for everybody to read your book. And then if you guys have anything, you know, any comments or anything, you know where to find me on social media as well. And, you know, keep the conversation going.
Yeah. So thanks so much.
Thank you. And best of luck with your release.
Okay. Thanks so much. It was nice having a conversation about it.
Thank you so much for listening. I really hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I did. If you enjoyed it, please go on iTunes and give us a review so that others can find us, and share it on your socials. Join me on Instagram at Paula Morales McDowell and keep the conversation going. What did you love? What questions do you have? Who do you want to hear from next? Catch you next week.